I'm Jonathan Aberman. Coming up on today's show...
There is no such thing as neutral technology, right? There are decisions that are made regardless. We are speaking on the heels of a very recent development with Gemini, right? With Google releasing Gemini and people saying it was too woke.
Welcome to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.
Today's show is going to introduce you to an entrepreneur who is entrepreneurial in the way that many people are, doing it on the DC dance floor, meeting between policy and business. It's Sean Perriman. He is head of algorithmic fairness at Uber. We're going to talk a bit about how he built his career and why DC is a great place to be, but there may be some warning signs for those of us that are concerned about making sure our most talented stay. So here's our conversation. Sean, it's great to have you.
Great to be here, Jonathan. Good to see you again.
Well, this show is mission-based around trying to make sure that people understand why we all work here, why we come here, where the opportunities are. And I've also shared with our audience some of my concerns about what this region is offering for, you know, frankly, people are building their careers. And, you know, your career, to me, is indicative of the unique way that people can build careers here, crossing public and policy and entrepreneurship. So... let's begin with this so our audience gets to know you a bit. How did you end up here? Did you grow up here?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting story. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York for the most part, but my parents moved down to the Virginia area when I was like seven. And so we spent some time here, like 3 or 4 years. My brother ended up staying. And so I was always back and forth between Virginia and New York. So a little bit of home here, but more identified as a New Yorker.
How would you compare the two places, you know, having been a New Yorker and now being here?
Yeah, I mean, it's really that question gives you a little snapshot of what things used to be. I lived in Manassas, Virginia back then, and it was nothing. It was like a two-road town. But the whole Northern Virginia area has completely changed and blown up since then. Now I live in Falls Church. But yeah, so New York was much more of a, obviously, in Brooklyn, a cosmopolitan city, everything very concentrated. Living in Virginia now, though, it's so diverse as well, and kind of a different type of diversity that I don't think people appreciate unless you live here.
So I moved down here from New York as well in 98, and not long after I moved here, I had an opportunity to do some policy work down in Richmond with then-Governor Governor Warner. Had a nice senior moment there, Governor Warner. And so I was invited down there my first time I went down there. And I parked at the hospital down there, and I walked out, and there's the Museum of the Confederacy with the cannons facing north. And I thought, this is not New York. It is interesting, isn't it, how Northern Virginia has become much more of an eastern northeastern community than other parts of the state or certainly the way it was 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it helps that we've gotten rid of all our Confederate name schools and all of those things as well. But I guess time changes all things. But yeah, it is much more of a northeastern city. I guess city is a way of saying it, but northeastern location. Mm. And I think you see that tension, too, with kind of Southern Virginia and then Northern Virginia and the way it's viewed.
So you kind of grew up here, but you didn't start your career here. You started in Texas, right?
Yeah, of all places. I started in Dallas, Texas. I went to Vanderbilt for law school, ended up in Dallas, Texas doing commercial litigation, not something I thought would have happened. But within like 4 or 5 years into my career, I realized I wanted to be back on the East Coast. My parents had retired to Virginia, and honestly, I was really interested in doing policy because I wanted to do something impactful.
So you were drawn to come here to get involved in policy and make a difference.
That was the hope, but I was stuck in Dallas, and so I think I've shared this with you before. Like, I actually would book a 3-day weekend, you know, book a trip every so often, come up here and just meet people for coffees, and I wouldn't really tell them. I'd be kind of vague about where I live, and just kept coming up here and doing that and meeting people for coffee and saying, hey, you know, I'm interested in this sort of work and getting into policy, and it took a while. Eventually, I got a job at a law firm here in D.C., but one of those coffees, someone called me about 6 months after we met, said, hey, I remember you. We had a coffee. There's an opening. And that led me into working in Congress.
It's interesting to me you describe coffee. I've never in my life, I mean, I worked in Europe, worked a lot in the financial district in England, and there it's not coffee, it was lots of beer. New York, nobody had time for coffee, it seemed, but down here, there's a lot of networking. Do you think it's because you've been involved in politics and policymaking? Is this a really political town? I mean, is that
it's a one horse town in some ways. Politics is kind of the industry here, but and let me be clear. I mean, it's not just coffee. There's a lot of happy hours, a lot of alcohol. There's a lot of all of that. The pandemic sort of wounded that custom, but it's still there. But I do think, and when I speak to people who are coming to D.C. for the first time, my whole thing is, you know, network and stay in touch with the person. I have so many people who I met maybe as a lowly staffer in Congress who became chief of staff and then went on to become, you know, grand poobah at whatever company. So it's just one of those places where people are in one place today and another place tomorrow.
Since you're on the subject, and we do have listeners who are building their careers, I will tell you, as somebody who people often reach out to because they want to network with me, I hate it when somebody shows up and says, hey, I want to pick your brain, you know, come out of nowhere. I want to pick your, what a terrible phrase. But also people who are very transactional, you know, and immediately expect an outcome. How did you approach networking as an outsider, insider coming in to get over, to be blunt, the suspicion that anybody who could actually help you would have because you're the 15th person who's probably asked for help that week?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, right? It's hard when you're looking for something not to be transactional, right? You are looking for an outcome, but I think you have to treat it as an outcome that maybe is 10, 20 years down the road, right? Like you treat it as a relationship that you're going to build on in some way and not the outcome of I need something at this moment. So at least that's the way I went into it. I would go meet with someone, get to know them, like say, hey, you know, I'm interested in this thing, but hey, I would love to get to know you in some way. And I think the other part of it too, what you're describing is sort of a one-way transaction. Hey, give me, give me, give me. Mm-hmm. I make a point of, hey, I saw a happy hour that I thought you may be interested in. I saw this article. I know you mentioned you're into, like, actually take interest in people. And I think that's the hard part is that there's so many people interested in their careers, but not so much interested in the people they encounter along the way.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, I believe that the most successful networkers are people that like meeting other folks and are patient. There's no quicker way to kill a nascent relationship than to try to turn into something actionable. The other thing I've learned and I use as a screen is if I meet somebody and they seem kind of interesting, I'll give them a project to do.
Oh, really?
No, seriously.
A little homework?
Well, no, well, I will. If somebody asks me for career advice, I'll say, well, go away and, you know, come back after you've figured out the five things that you like best out of each job and let's talk about it. Try to come up with something actionable. And, you know, it's really funny and sad how few people actually follow up.
Yeah.
But the ones that do are the ones that I have relationships with.
You know, it's funny you say that and I kind of scoffed at it, but I guess I do the same thing. I don't tell them, give me five things, but like I will never say, hey, I'll email you about what we talked. It's like, you know, I make the action item for them to do because if they don't follow up, then why should I, right? Like, I'm not going to chase my tail for that. But, yeah, I think that's right. If you're the person trying to seek something, you've got to put a little effort in.
I think that's right. And you have to be patient, and that's hard to do. And it's funny because best practices whenever somebody's unemployed is go network.
Yeah.
And then people, I got to get a job. That's not networking.
Yeah.
That is please hire me.
Please hire me, right.
And that rarely works.
Yeah.
Now, You came here, you spent an awful lot of money on spec, very entrepreneurial behavior, found your way here, started as a lawyer, got better. What did you decide to do? How did you begin to build your, what I'll call your entrepreneurial career?
Right. So once I left the law practice, I was lucky enough to work for Congressman Elijah Cummings. I worked on the House Oversight Committee way back when they thought Hillary Clinton would be president. Didn't work out that way. Mm. But when I was on the committee, I definitely had in mind from the very beginning, I want to pick up some skill that's outside of law that I could use in some way. And so lucky me, the tech subcommittee was sort of unmanned in a way. And so I went and managed that. This was in 2015, 2016. So at that time, believe it or not, that was the first time people were really talking about algorithmic bias, facial recognition, AI in any serious way on the Hill. Mm. Those are the years that we had the first congressional hearings on that. So it was a little bit of chance, but a little bit of me just saying, I want to have something that's outside of law that I know and that I can kind of take away from this. And so it worked out for me in that sense that I ended up in this space where I managed our committee in probably one of the first hearings on facial recognition in the history of Congress. And so when people are talking about bias in AI now, like I've been doing this for about 8 years now.
And I'm definitely going to want to touch on this some with our time together. Before I go there, it strikes me as I look at your career, and we'll talk pretty soon about what you're doing now. You know, you had a foray where you ran for public office. You've been in charge of different advocacy organizations. You've been really making a difference in a lot of ways. But I look at you and I see you're very much an entrepreneur in my mind. You know, you're very self-directed. And I wonder, do you think that being here shaped your entrepreneurial behavior? So, for example, if you'd been in Silicon Valley, do you think you would have been doing public policy? Do you think you would have been doing a startup?
That's a great question. I think about that too. And I guess, you know, I'm still early enough where maybe someday I will be, right? But yeah, I think I would have been doing something where I felt like I could be impactful. It's never really been to me, oh, this is the thing. Like I do X or I do Y. It's like, what can I do that will have some sort of impact? And I know that sounds kind of fuzzy, but to me, it's been pretty clear. Like, it's not necessarily that I'm chasing policy. It's just like, this is where I think I can have the most influence on something, on like the world around me. Now, we can get to that, but I think policy has less of that impact these days.
Mm.
But that is definitely the thinking I had at the time.
You know, when I talk about entrepreneurial behavior, I always describe it from the standpoint, it's a personality attribute, and then we find the dance floor that we dance on.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that here in D.C., where there are all these opportunities to help make policy, to make a difference, become a public servant, it drives a lot of us in that direction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when we come back after the break, you've teased it beautifully, Sean. I've spent other shows talking about AI and its influence in society. Mm-hmm. You're in the middle of a particularly important issue. And after the break, let's talk a bit about what you mean when you talk about algorithmic fairness and how it relates to AI. And I'm sure I'll have some other interesting things to say about whether or not this is continuing to be a great place for people to build careers. So I'm here with Sean Perriman, and we'll be right back. Has a mission, you know that. It's to make us all better informed and to promote DC as a place where we can build great careers and also the challenges we have to overcome. If you want to help, you can do the following things. First, send us your guest suggestions. If you think somebody's interesting, I'll think they're interesting too. Reach out to me through LinkedIn. I'll answer your email. The second thing is, if you like the show, subscribe. There's no better way for us to be able to keep doing this than have our audience grow. Or better yet, tell a friend. Invite a friend to subscribe, or just give us a like. It seems like such a simple thing, but you know, it actually makes a difference. So thanks for listening. Algorithmic fairness policy at Uber. Before we took our break, I teased us all that we were going to come back and talk some about exactly this, algorithmic fairness and AI. So, Sean, we glossed over it, but we're not going to talk much about it. But you had your foray in running for public office. You thought about being a politician. You've settled on influencing the society by getting involved in policy, this really important tech company. What exactly, let's start with the basics. What does algorithmic fairness actually mean, and how does it relate to artificial intelligence?
That's such a great question. I mean, we can think about artificial intelligence. A lot of people think about sort of the science fiction of things, right? It's just basically trying to get machines that can do things that we normally associate with humans at a very basic level, right? Mm. Algorithms are the sort of set of instructions in there that make these things happen. Again, just sort of making it as plain as possible. But when we think about machines and AI, sometimes we have the misconception that if a machine does something, it can't be unfair. It can't be. It's a machine. Mm. And that's not true because it's influenced by the data we train it on. So a lot of times the data itself can be biased. I mean, the classic example is they had AI systems that they trained to do sentencing software. Mm-hmm. And it was basically picking up on the bias that if you lived in a certain income, you were a certain skin color, you were certain that you usually got a higher sentence. So it kept doing that. It kept replicating that same bias. So we weren't actually mm-hmm. solving anything. We were just making this discrimination more efficient in some ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this sort of bias can go in all sorts of things. It's not always racial. It could be gender. It could be income. It could just be behaving in a way we just don't want it to behave. Mm-hmm. So these are sort of the things when we think about algorithmic fairness is like, how can we be fair in the way that we use AI systems? How do we make sure the consumer understands and there are decisions being made in a way that people say, you know what, that makes sense?
I think that the way you described AI and the way most people think about it is it's this black box. Mm-hmm. And the black box will operate and whatever comes out of it must be truth. And we're seeing in various places in our society now that AI doesn't create truth; it just creates output, mm-hmm. and it's a model. It's a black box. So a lot of the times, I don't even think the people that are writing the code actually know how it's working.
Yeah, I mean, with machine learning and some of the things that come out of that, they're not really sure how it gets to the exact outcome that it comes to. And also, as you said, there are people making it, and they have their mm-hmm. own biases as well, right? Like, so you. They have their own sort of prejudices, not necessarily discrimination, just the way they think things work.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you react when the inevitable person says, well, this is just being woke, right? I mean, how do you I know how I respond, but
yeah.
How do you respond when somebody says, well, you're introducing politics into technology and technology is agnostic of politics?
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, I'm actually, I'm teaching a course, a cyber law course at Marymount. And one of the first things or one of the main things I want students to understand is that there is no such thing as neutral technology, right? There are mm-hmm. decisions that are made regardless. Now, you can make the argument that some decisions are making it too woke, whatever woke means.
Right, exactly. Whatever it means. It means you're making me uncomfortable, is what it means these days.
I don't agree with that. It's too woke. So those are the things. But, we are speaking on the heels of a very recent development with Gemini, right, with mm-hmm. Google releasing Gemini and people saying it was too woke. It was interesting to me that was the takeaway they took from it. I actually took from it that a lot of companies are releasing things that are not ready for consumption.
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily it could have been too woke. It could have been too racist.
Right.
It could have been any number of things, but it wasn't ready.
There are no guard. You're absolutely right. Or you think about this recent, relatively recent event with the Canadian airline where the AI hallucinated on its pricing strategies. Gave away and they had to give away a bunch of flights at a low price.
That is like the race with generative AI, this race to the market, right? Mm. It's so cool. Investors like it. It's a race to the market. And it's not necessarily saying, hey, is this operating in the way that we are intending it to or that the consumer intends it to? Like you think, hey, if I tell you to make a picture of the founding fathers, it's going to be historically accurate. And that's the problem that we ran in with Gemini. Mm. They overcorrected for other things and ended up with some inaccuracy.
You know, it's funny you use that image. I mean, it's not a new phenomenon that knowledge gets tainted or misreported. You know, for example, I'm a geek when it comes to Roman history. The statues that we look at and think are the Roman emperors, none of them looked like they did. Those are just images that people just decide along the way. Caligula looked like a certain way. Society has prejudices.
I'll get in trouble, but I mean, we pass 1,000 blonde hair, blue eyed Jesuses everywhere we go, right? Like that is the popularized version of Jesus,
right?
Right. So I mean, at some
probably didn't look like that if he was living where he lived.
Definitely did.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So I mean, so it's something that as a society we have collective hallucinations that we accept.
So you're right in the middle of this, and taking an entrepreneurial journey into policy in the, I would say, the most important technological trend that we are facing involved in right now. Silicon Valley is just, as you say, just pumping the stuff out as fast as they can without any sort of remorse. What do you think, how do you think it's going to end up? And what is it going to mean for people in your field, in your mid-career? You could be here, you could be there.
Mm-hmm.
How and why would somebody stay dancing here if they can be out there?
Well, and it gets into like the DC policy space. When I came here and when I got into this, it was because I was tired of preparing cases that, you know, the only thing they mattered to were the rich people on either side. Mm-hmm. They usually settled whatever. I wanted to have some sort of impact. Hey, mm-hmm. I read the newspaper. Oh, yeah, that's something I'm working on. That was interesting to me. But as we talk about the policy space, and specifically I was working in government, you don't see that. It's still in the newspaper, but the newspaper headline is nothing has happened again, right? Mm. Like we are seeing just statistically the most ineffective Congress in history. We're seeing at a time where we just don't seem as a country we can do big things anymore from a government perspective. Where we do see that happening is the private sector. We have Tesla with the most satellites in the sky. They're ones building the electric vehicle infrastructure.
Yeah.
We have companies that are reimagining the way we think about all sorts of things. So I think what you'll see is if people are really drawn to, I want to have impact. I want to be an entrepreneur in that sense. I want to do something important. They're not going to find it in government. They're going to say, this is where old people go to yell at each other. And this is not where I'm going to go and waste my best years. So I think we're going to see more and more of that, and that will lead to this drain from D.C.
So isn't it interesting that what you're talking about is areas where we need policy desperately,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Because you're in the field you're in where you've got AI models that don't have guardrails, that has to be policy.
Yep.
But the people that actually would be interested in doing those policies, you think you're just they're getting disaffected. There, as you, the way you described it, I think was very very trenchant. Is old people yelling at each other?
Well, yeah, it's,
you know, I mean that's pretty powerful.
Have you watched any of the hearings where Congress takes on the tech companies? They don't understand how the technology that all of us are using every day works.
Yes.
Now they're getting close to this TikTok ban. As long as you say something is a Chinese threat, they get that. That's old school. They don't understand the sort of day-to-day what's going on or how the technology works, and that's true with all the major issues. You know, you mentioned I ran for office. I ran in 2021. That's because Virginia has off-year elections. But I ran I started running in 2020. That was the first time I thought in my life that, you know, we could do something different. All the issues that we had ever faced, whether it's public health, racism, climate— it seemed like people were willing to rethink things. And then we ended up just banning books and talking about being woke. So, you know, I came to the kind of same conclusion that nothing serious is going to happen here from these government actors, right? Like, I don't know if I would ever run again just because I don't know if I have faith in that system. Now, maybe eventually push will come to shove and people will have to change the systems. And I think we're getting to that point as a country, which is a both scary and intriguing thought. But yeah, to answer your question, all the big questions don't seem like they're going to be answered by the people that we watch on CNN and MSNBC or Fox News or whatever you watch every day.
So if I told you that the data gathered by LinkedIn shows that 30 to 50-year-olds, there's an outflow, significant outflow of professionals to other parts of the country, sounds like that wouldn't surprise you very much.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, especially the people in their prime earning years, prime career years. I mean, it's probably a mix of things, right? DC becoming more expensive, all the other things that are attributed to that. But then on top of that, if you can't have that impact in your career, or if you see somewhere else that you can go where you can kind of drive something, of course you're going to leave.
I spend, I'm fortunate, more than a little bit of time talking with policymakers and leaders in the business community here. If you were sitting with me, what would be your advice about what would have to change to make sure that there was an inflow of 30 to 50-year-old talented people into this region?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't think there's any one answer, but if we're talking from a career perspective, I think you have to have a more diversity in the industries. You have to diversify your industries. Because right now, I think D.C. is seen as, you work for the government, you're either a contractor, this or that. There's other companies here, but I don't know if that's really as visible as people who are making that that choice of where they want to move and start their careers would think.
It's interesting. So you think in part it's a marketing issue?
Yeah, in part, because when people think about this region, I don't think they think about other industries other than working for government.
I think you're right. And personally, I think it is a marketing challenge. I also think that there's an infrastructure problem and we don't have enough product people here. But to my mind, both of those are problems that could be solved if folks who like to spend money on sports teams decide to spend money on economic development, for example. Just saying.
Oh, we'll attract some athletes.
Well, there's that. Maybe one day we'll have a basketball team too.
Right.
So any final thoughts for our listeners that are thinking about building a career here or any final advice you'd like to share?
Sure. I mean, in the spirit of talking about being an entrepreneur, you have to take the chance on yourself. There's many times in my career where I made a complete switch. Even if it's spending a bunch of money coming here to just talk and have coffee with people, running for office, trying to be an advocate, all of those things, there wasn't a sure outcome. It was just something that you kind of bet on yourself.
Well, you're a great example of how I think entrepreneurs dance the dance floor of D.C., Sean, and I really appreciate you sharing your stories with our audience today. It was Sean Perriman, head of algorithmic fairness policy at Uber. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This program is brought to you in partnership with George Mason University's Center for Regional Analysis. The CRA is the region's leading voice in economic data and forecasting. Check out their work at cra.gmu.edu. What's Working in Washington is a team effort. We have a great team. Tracy Madigan is our executive producer and editor. Laura Latendresse is our digital producer. The theme music you've been listening to is performed by the Sunbathers. And thanks to all of you for joining us on What's Working in Washington.
You've been listening to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.